used it to purchase wines. According to him, it worked out great. The quality of the wines he drank noticeably improved. If your goal is to predict the future, what wine will taste good, what products will sell, which horses will run fast, you do not need to worry too much about why your model works exactly as it does. Just get the numbers right. That's the second lesson of Jeff Sater's horse story. The final lesson to be learned from Sater's successful attempt to predict a potential Triple Crown winner is that you have to be open and flexible in determining what counts as data. It's not as if the old-time horse agents were oblivious to data before Sater came along. They scrutinized race times and pedigree charts. Sater's genius was to look for data where others hadn't looked before, to consider non-traditional sources of data. For a data scientist, a fresh and original perspective can pay off. Words as data. One day in 2004, two young economists with an expertise in media, then PhD students at Harvard, were reading about a recent court decision in Massachusetts legalizing gay marriage. The economists Matt Jenskow and Jesse Shapiro noticed something interesting. Two newspapers employed strikingly different language to report the same story. The Washington Times, which has a reputation for being conservative, headlined the story, "Homosexuals Marry in Massachusetts," marry with quotes. The Washington Post, which has a reputation for being liberal, reported that there had been a victory for, quote-unquote, same-sex couples. It's no surprise that different news organizations can tilt in different directions, that newspapers can cover the same story with a different focus. For years, in fact, Jenskow and Shapiro had been pondering if they might use their economics training to help understand media bias. Why do some news organizations seem to take a more liberal view and others a more conservative one? But Jenskow and Shapiro didn't really have any ideas on how they might tackle this question. They couldn't figure out how they could systematically and objectively measure media subjectivity. What Jenskow and Shapiro found interesting then about the gay marriage story was not that news organizations differed in their coverage. It was how the newspaper's coverage differed. It came down to a distinct shift in word choice. In 2004, homosexuals, as used by the Washington Times, was an old-fashioned and disparaging way to describe gay people, whereas same-sex couples, as used by the Washington Post, emphasized that gay relationships were just another form of romance. The scholars wondered whether language might be the key to understanding bias. Did liberals and conservatives consistently use different phrases? Could the words that newspapers use in stories be turned into data? What might this reveal about the American press? Could we figure out whether the press was liberal or conservative, and could we figure out why? In 2004, these weren't idle questions. The billions of words in American newspapers were no longer trapped on newsprint or microfilm. Certain websites now recorded every word included in every story for nearly every newspaper in the United States. Jenskow and Shapiro could scrape these sites and quickly test the extent to which language could measure newspaper bias. And by doing this, they could sharpen our understanding of how the news media works. But before describing what they found, let's leave for a moment the story of Jenskow and Shapiro and their attempt to quantify the language in newspapers and discuss how scholars across a wide range of fields have utilized this new type of data, words, to better understand human nature. Language has, of course, always been a topic of interest to social scientists. However, studying language generally required the close reading of texts, and turning huge swaths of text into data wasn't feasible. Now with computers and digitization, tabulating words across massive sets of documents is easy. Language has thus become subject to big data analysis. The links that Google utilized were composed of words. So were the Google searches that I study. Words feature frequently in this audiobook, but language is so important to the big data revolution, it deserves its own section. In fact, it's being used so much now that there's an entire field devoted to it, text as data. A major development in this field is Google Ngrams. A few years ago, two young biologists, Erez Eiden and Jean-Baptiste Michel, had their research assistants counting words one by one in old, dusty texts to try to find new insights on how certain usages of words spread. One day, Aydin and Michelle heard about a new project by Google to digitize a large portion of the world's books. Almost immediately, the biologists grasped that this would be a much easier way to understand the history of language. "We realized our methods were so hopelessly obsolete," Aydin told Discover magazine. "It was clear that you couldn't compete with this juggernaut of digitization. So they decided to collaborate with the search company. With the help of Google engineers, they created a service that searches through the millions of digitized books for a particular word or phrase. It then will tell researchers how frequently that word or phrase appeared in every year, from 1800 to 2010. So what can we learn from the frequency with which words or phrases appear in books in different years? For one thing, we learn about the slow growth in popularity of sausage and the relatively recent and rapid growth in popularity of pizza. On the enhancement, you'll find a graph that outlines this. But there are lessons far more profound than that. For instance, Google Ngrams can teach us how national identity formed. One fascinating example is presented in Aydin and Michelle's book, Uncharted. First, a quick question. Do you think the United States is currently a united or a divided country? If you are like most people, you would say the United States is divided these days due to the high level of political polarization. You might even say the country is about as divided as it has ever been. America, after all, is now color-coded. Red states are Republican, blue states are Democratic. But in Uncharted, Aydin and Michelle note one fascinating data point that reveals just how much more divided the United States once was. The data point is the language people use to talk about the country. Note the words I used just now when I discussed how divided the country is. I said the United States is divided. I referred to the United States as a singular noun. This is natural. It's proper grammar and standard usage. I'm sure you didn't even notice. However, Americans didn't always speak this way. In the early days of the country, Americans referred to the United States using the plural form. For example, John Adams, in his 1799 State of the Union address, referred to the United States in their treaties with His Britannic Majesty. If Everybody Lies were written in 1800, I would have said, the United States are divided. This little usage difference has long been a fascination for historians, since it suggests there was a point when America stopped thinking of itself as a collection of states and started thinking of itself as one nation. So when did this happen? Historians, Uncharted informs us, have never been sure as there has been no systematic way to test it, but many have long suspected the cause was the Civil War. In fact, James McPherson, former president of the American Historical Association and a Pulitzer Prize winner, noted bluntly, "The war marked a transition of the United States to a singular noun." But it turns out McPherson was wrong. Google Ngrams gave Aydin and Michelle a systematic way to check this. They could see how frequently American books used the phrase, the United States are versus the United States is, for every year in the country's history. The transformation was more gradual and didn't accelerate until well after the Civil War ended. Take a look at the next graph on the enhancement. 15 years after the Civil War, there were still more uses of the United States are than the United States is, showing the country was still divided linguistically. Military victories happen quicker than changes in mindsets. So much for how a country unites. How do a man and woman unite? Words can help here, too. For example, we can predict whether a man and woman will go on a second date based on how they speak on the first date. This was shown by an interdisciplinary team of Stanford and Northwestern scientists, Daniel McFarland, Dan Jurafsky, and Craig Rawlings. They studied hundreds of heterosexual speed daters and tried to determine what predicts whether they will feel a connection and want a second date. They first used traditional data. They asked daters for their height, weight, and hobbies, and tested how these factors correlated with someone reporting a spark of romantic interest. Women, on average, prefer men who are taller and share their hobbies. Men, on average, prefer women who are skinnier and share their hobbies. Nothing new there. But the scientists also collected a new type of data. They instructed the daters to take tape recorders with them. The recordings of the dates were then digitized. The scientists were thus able to code the words used, the presence of laughter, and the tone of voice. They could test both how men and women signaled they were interested and how partners earned that interest. So what did the linguistic data tell us? First, how a man or woman conveys that he or she is interested. One of the ways a man signals that he is attracted is obvious. He laughs at a woman's jokes. Another is less obvious. When speaking, he limits the range of his pitch. There is research that suggests a monotone voice is often seen by women as masculine, which implies that men, perhaps subconsciously, exaggerate their masculinity when they like a woman. The scientists found that a woman signals her interest by varying her pitch, speaking more softly, and taking shorter turns talking. There are also major clues about a woman's interest based on the particular words she uses. A woman is unlikely to be interested when she uses hedge words and phrases such as probably or I guess. Fellas, if a woman is hedging her statements on any topic, if she sorta likes her drink or kinda feels chilly or probably will have another hors d'oeuvre, you can bet that she is sorta, kinda, probably not into you. A woman is likely to be interested when she talks about herself. It turns out that for a man looking to connect, the most beautiful word you can hear from a woman's mouth may be I. It's a sign she's feeling comfortable. A woman also is likely to be interested if she uses self-marking phrases such as you know and I mean. Why? The scientists noted that these phrases invite the listener's attention. They are friendly and warm and suggest a person is looking to connect. You know what I mean? Now, how can men and women communicate in order to get a date interested in them? The data tells us that there are plenty of ways a man can talk to raise the chances a woman likes him. Women like men who follow their lead. Perhaps not surprisingly, a woman is more likely to report a connection if a man laughs at her jokes and keeps the conversation on topics she introduces rather than constantly changing the subject to those he wants to talk about. One theory I am working on, big data just confirms everything the late Leonard Cohen ever said. For example, Leonard Cohen once gave his nephew the following advice for wooing women. Listen well, then listen some more, and when you think you're done listening, listen some more. That seems to be roughly similar to what these scientists found. Women also like men who express support and sympathy. If a man says, "That's awesome," or "That's really cool," a woman is significantly more likely to report a connection. Likewise, if he uses phrases such as, "That's tough," or "You must be sad." For women, there is some bad news here, as the data seems to confirm a distasteful truth about men. Conversation plays only a small role in how they respond to women. Physical appearance trumps all else in predicting whether a man reports a connection. That said, there is one word that a woman can use to at least slightly improve the odds a man likes her, and it's one we've already discussed. I. Men are more likely to report clicking with a woman who talks about herself, and as previously noted, a woman is also more likely to report a connection after a date where she talks about herself. Thus, it is a great sign on a first date if there is substantial discussion about the woman. The woman signals her comfort and probably appreciates that the man is not hogging the conversation, and the man likes that the woman is opening up. A second date is likely. Finally, there is one clear indicator of trouble in a date transcript. A question mark. If there are lots of questions asked on a date, it is less likely that both the man and the woman will report a connection. This seems counterintuitive. You might think that questions are a sign of interest, but not so on a first date. On a first date, most questions are signs of boredom. What are your hobbies? How many brothers and sisters do you have? These are the kinds of things people say when the conversation stalls. A great first date may include a single question at the end. Will you go out with me again? If this is the only question on the date, the answer is likely to be yes. And men and women don't just talk differently when they're trying to woo each other. They talk differently in general. A team of psychologists analyzed the words used in hundreds of thousands of Facebook posts. They measured how frequently every word is used by men and women. They could then declare which are the most masculine and most feminine words in the English language. Many of these word preferences, alas, were obvious. For example, women talk about shopping and my hair much more frequently than men do. Men talk about football and Xbox much more frequently than women do. You probably didn't need a team of psychologists analyzing big data to tell you that. Some of the findings, however, were more interesting. Women use the word tomorrow far more often than men do, perhaps because men aren't so great at thinking ahead. Adding the letter O to the word so is one of the most feminine linguistic traits. Among the words most disproportionately used by women are so, 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 and so. Maybe it was my childhood exposure to women who weren't afraid to throw the occasional F-bomb, but I always thought cursing was an equal opportunity trait. Not so. Among the words used much more frequently by men than women are fuck, shit, fucks, bullshit, fucking, and fuckers. On the enhancement are word clouds showing words used mostly by men and those used mostly by women. The larger a word appears, the more that word's use tilts toward that gender. What I like about this study is the new data informs us of patterns that have long existed, but we hadn't necessarily been aware of. Men and women have always spoken in different ways, but for hundreds of thousands of years, this data disappeared as soon as the sound waves faded in space. Now this data is preserved on computers and can be analyzed by computers. Or perhaps what I should have said given my gender, the words used to fucking disappear. Now we can take a break from watching football and playing Xbox and learn this shit. That is, if anyone gives a fuck. It isn't just men and women who speak differently. People use different words as they age. This might even give us some clues as to how the aging process plays out. Here, from the same study, are the words most disproportionately used by people of different ages on Facebook. I call this graphic Drink, Work, Pray, and it's found on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. In people's teens, they're drinking. In their 20s, they're working. In their 30s and onward, they are praying. A powerful new tool for analyzing text is something called sentiment analysis. Scientists can now estimate how happy or sad a particular passage of text is. How? Teams of scientists have asked large numbers of people to code tens of thousands of words in the English language as positive or negative. The most positive words, according to this methodology, include happy, love, and awesome. The most negative words include sad, death, and depression. They thus have built an index of the mood of a huge set of words. Using this index, they can measure the average mood of words in a passage of text. If someone writes, "I am happy and in love and feeling awesome," sentiment analysis would code that as extremely happy text. If someone writes, "I am sad, thinking about all the world's death and depression," the sentiment analysis would code that as extremely sad text. Other pieces of text would be somewhere in between. So what can you learn when you code the mood of text? Facebook data scientists have shown one exciting possibility. They can estimate a country's gross national happiness every day. If people's status messages tend to be positive, the country is assumed happy for the day. If they tend to be negative, the country is assumed sad for the day. Among the Facebook data scientists' findings, Christmas is one of the happiest days of the year. Now, I was skeptical of this analysis, and am a bit skeptical of this whole project. Generally, I think many people are secretly sad on Christmas because they are lonely or fighting with their family. More generally, I tend not to trust Facebook status updates for reasons that I will discuss in the next chapter, namely, our propensity to lie about our lives on social media. If you're alone and miserable on Christmas, do you really want to bother all of your friends by posting about how unhappy you are? I suspect there are many people spending a joyless Christmas who still post on Facebook about how grateful they are for their wonderful, awesome, amazing, happy life. They then get coded as substantially raising America's gross national happiness. If we are really going to code gross national happiness, we should use more sources than just Facebook status updates. That said, the finding that Christmas is on balance a joyous occasion does seem legitimately to be true. Google searches for depression and Gallup surveys also tell us that Christmas is among the happiest days of the year, and contrary to an urban myth, suicides drop around the holidays. Even if there are some sad and lonely people on Christmas, there are many more merry ones. These days, when people sit down to read, most of the time it is to peruse status updates on Facebook. But once upon a time, not so long ago, human beings read stories, sometimes in books. Sentiment analysis can teach us a lot here, too. A team of scientists led by Andy Reagan, now at the University of California at Berkeley School of Information, downloaded the text of thousands of books and movie scripts. They could then code how happy or sad each point of the story was. Consider, for example, the book Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. On the enhancement, you'll find a graph from that team of scientists showing how the mood of the story changes along with a description of key plot points. Note that the many rises and falls in mood that the sentiment analysis detects corresponds to key events. Most stories have simpler structures. Take, for example, Shakespeare's tragedy King John. In this play, nothing goes right. King John of England is asked to renounce his throne. He's excommunicated for disobeying the Pope. War breaks out. His nephew dies, perhaps by suicide. Other people die. Finally, John is poisoned by a disgruntled monk. And on the enhancement is a graph showing the sentiment analysis as the play progresses. In other words, just from the words, the computer was able to detect that things go from bad to worse to worst. Or consider the movie 127 Hours. A basic plot summary of this movie is as follows. A mountaineer goes to Utah's Canyonlands National Park to hike. He befriends other hikers, but then parts ways with them. Suddenly he slips and knocks loose a boulder, which traps his hand and wrist. He attempts various escapes, but each one fails. He becomes depressed. Finally, he amputates his arm and escapes. He gets married, starts a family, and continues climbing, although now he makes sure to leave a note whenever he goes off. And on the enhancement is another graph showing the sentiment analysis as the movie progresses, again by Reagan's team of scientists. So what do we learn from the mood of thousands of these stories? The computer scientists found that a huge percentage of stories fit into one of six relatively simple structures. They are, borrowing a chart from Reagan's team, rags to riches, rise, riches to rags, fall, man in a hole, fall then rise, Icarus, rise then fall, Cinderella, rise then fall then rise, Oedipus, fall then rise then fall. There might be small twists and turns not captured by this simple scheme. For example, 127 Hours ranks as a man in a hole story, even though there are moments along the way down when sentiments temporarily improve. The large overarching structure of most stories fit into one of the six categories. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows is an exception. There are a lot of additional questions we might answer. For example, how has the structure of stories changed through time? Have stories gotten more complicated through the years? Do cultures differ in the types of stories they tell? What types of stories do people like most? Do different story structures appeal to men and women? What about people in different countries? Ultimately, text as data may give us unprecedented insights into what audiences actually want, which may be different from what authors or executives think they want. Already there are some clues that point in this direction. Consider a study by two Wharton School professors, Jonah Berger and Catherine L. Milkman, on what types of stories get shared. They tested whether positive stories or negative stories were more likely to make the New York Times most emailed list. They downloaded every Times article over a 3-month period. Using sentiment analysis, the professors coded the mood of articles. Examples of positive stories included wide-eyed new arrivals falling in love with the city and Tony Award for philanthropy. Stories such as web rumors tied to Korean actress suicide and Germany, baby polar bear's feeder dies, proved not surprisingly to be negative. The professors also had information about where the story was placed. Was it on the homepage, on the top right, the top left? And they had information about when the story came out. Late Tuesday night, Monday morning. They could compare two articles, one of them positive, one of them negative, that appeared in a similar place on the Times site and came out at a similar time, and see which one was more likely to be emailed. So what gets shared, positive or negative articles? Positive articles. As the authors conclude, content is more likely to become viral the more positive it is. Note, this would seem to contrast with the conventional journalistic wisdom that people are attracted to violent and catastrophic stories. It may be true that news media give people plenty of dark stories, There is something to the newsroom adage, if it leads, it leads. The Wharton professor's study, however, suggests that people may actually want more cheery stories. It may suggest a new adage, if it smiles, it's emailed. Though that doesn't really rhyme. So much for sad and happy text. How do you figure out what words are liberal or conservative? And what does that tell us about the modern news media? This is a bit more complicated, which brings us back to Genscow and Shapiro. Remember, they were the economists who saw gay marriage described different ways in two different newspapers and wondered if they could use language to uncover political bias. The first thing these two ambitious young scholars did was examine transcripts of the congressional record. Since this record was already digitized, they could download every word used by every Democratic congressperson in 2005 and every word used by every Republican congressperson in 2005. They could then see if certain phrases were significantly more likely to be used by Democrats or Republicans. Some were indeed. Here are a few examples in each category. Phrases used far more by Democrats included estate tax, privatized Social Security, Rosa Parks, workers' rights, and poor people. Phrases used far more by Republicans include death tax, reform Social Security, Saddam Hussein, private property rights, and government spending. What explains these differences in language? Sometimes Democrats and Republicans use different phrasing to describe the same concept. In 2005, Republicans tried to cut the federal inheritance tax. They tended to describe it as a death tax, which sounds like an imposition upon the newly deceased. Democrats described it as an estate tax, which sounds like a tax on the wealthy. Similarly, Republicans tried to move Social Security into individual retirement accounts. To Republicans, this was a reform. To Democrats, this was a more dangerous-sounding privatization. Sometimes differences in language are a question of emphasis. Republicans and Democrats presumably both have great respect for Rosa Parks, the civil rights hero, but Democrats talked about her more frequently. Likewise, Democrats and Republicans presumably both think that Saddam Hussein, the former leader of Iraq, was an evil dictator, but Republicans repeatedly mentioned him in their attempt to justify the Iraq War. Similarly, workers' rights and concern for poor people are core principles of the Democratic Party. Private property rights and cutting government spending are core principles of Republicans. And these differences in language use are substantial. For example, in 2005, congressional Republicans used the phrase death tax 365 times and estate tax only 46 times. For congressional Democrats, the pattern was reversed. They used the phrase death tax only 35 times and estate tax 195 times. And if these words can tell us whether a congressperson is a Democrat or a Republican, the scholars realized they could also tell us whether a newspaper tilts left or right. Just as Republican congresspeople might be more likely to use the phrase death tax to persuade people to oppose it, conservative newspapers might do the same. The relatively liberal Washington Post used the phrase estate tax 13.7 times more frequently than they used the phrase death tax. The conservative Washington Times used death tax and estate tax about the same amount. Thanks to the wonders of the Internet, Genscow and Shapiro could analyze the language used in a large number of the nation's newspapers. The scholars utilized two websites, newslibrary.com and ProQuest.com, which together had digitized 433 newspapers. They then counted how frequently 1,000 such politically charged phrases were used in newspapers in order to measure the paper's political slant. The most liberal newspaper by this measure proved to be the Philadelphia Daily News, the most conservative, the Billings, Montana Gazette. When you have the first comprehensive measure of media bias for such a wide swath of outlets, you can answer perhaps the most important question about the press: why do some publications lean left and others right? The economists quickly homed in on one key factor, the politics of a given area. If an area is generally liberal, as Philadelphia and Detroit are, the dominant newspaper there tends to be liberal. If an area is more conservative, as are Billings and Amarillo, Texas, the dominant paper there tends to be conservative. In other words, the evidence strongly suggests that newspapers are inclined to give their readers what they want. You might think a paper's owner would have some influence on the slant of its coverage, but as a rule, who owns a paper has less effect than we might think upon its political bias. Note what happens when the same person or company owns papers in different markets. Consider the New York Times Company. It owns what Genscow and Shapiro find to be the liberal-leaning New York Times based in New York City, where roughly 70% of the population is Democratic. It also owned at the time of the study the conservative-leaning, by their measure, Spartanburg Herald Journal in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where roughly 70% of the population is Republican. There are exceptions, of course. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation owns what just about anyone would find to be the conservative New York Post, but overall, the findings suggest that the market determines newspaper slants far more than owners do. The study has a profound impact on how we think about the news media. Many people, particularly Marxists, have viewed American journalism as controlled by rich people or corporations with the goal of influencing the masses, perhaps to push people toward their political views. Genscow and Shapiro's paper suggests, however, that this is not the predominant motivation of owners. The owners of the American press, instead, are primarily giving the masses what they want so that the owners can become even richer. Oh, and one more question, a big, controversial, and perhaps even more provocative question. Do the American news media on average slant left or right? Are the media on average liberal or conservative? Genscow and Shapiro found that newspapers slant left. The average newspaper is more similar, in the words it uses, to a Democratic congressperson than it is to a Republican congressperson. Aha! Conservative readers may be ready to scream, I told you so! Many conservatives have long suspected newspapers have been biased to try to manipulate the masses to support left-wing viewpoints. Not so, say the authors. In fact, the liberal bias is well calibrated to what newspaper readers want. Newspaper readership, on average, tilts a bit left. They have data on that. And newspapers, on average, tilt a bit left to give their readers the viewpoints they demand. There is no grand conspiracy. There is just capitalism. The news media, Genscow and Shapiro's results imply, often operate like every other industry on the planet. Just as supermarkets figure out what ice cream people want and fill their shelves with it, newspapers figure out what viewpoints people want and fill their pages with it. It's just a business, Shapiro told me. That is what you can learn when you break down and quantify matters as convoluted as news, analysis, and opinion into their component parts, words. Pictures as data. Traditionally, when academics or business people wanted data, they conducted surveys. The data came neatly formed, drawn from numbers or checked boxes on questionnaires. This is no longer the case. The days of structured, clean, simple survey-based data are over. In this new age, the messy traces we leave as we go through life are becoming the primary source of data. As we've already seen, words are data, clicks are data, links are data, typos are data, bananas in dreams are data, tone of voice is data, wheezing is data, heartbeats are data, spleen size is data. Searches are, I argue, the most revelatory data. Pictures, it turns out, are data too. Just as words, which were once confined to books and periodicals on dusty shelves, have now been digitized, pictures have been liberated from albums and cardboard boxes. They, too, have been transformed into bits and released into the cloud. And as text can give us history lessons, showing us, for example, the changing ways people have spoken, pictures can give us history lessons showing us, for example, the changing ways people have posed. Consider an ingenious study by a team of four computer scientists at Brown and Berkeley. They took advantage of a neat digital era development. Many high schools have scanned their historical yearbooks and made them available online. Across the internet, the researchers found 949 scanned yearbooks from American high schools spanning the years 1905 through 2013. This included tens of thousands of senior portraits. Using computer software, they were able to create an average face out of the pictures from every decade. In other words, they could figure out the average location and configuration of people's noses, eyes, lips, and hair. on the enhancement are the average faces from across the last century, plus broken down by gender. Notice anything? Americans, and particularly women, started smiling. They went from nearly stone-faced at the start of the 20th century to beaming by the end. So why the change? Did Americans get happier? Nope. Other scholars have helped answer this question. The reason is, at least to me, fascinating. When photographs were first invented, people thought of them like paintings. There was nothing else to compare them to. Thus, subjects in photos copied subjects in paintings. And since people sitting for portraits couldn't hold a smile for the many hours the painting took, they adopted a serious look. Subjects in photos adopted the same look. What finally got them to change? Business, profit, and marketing, of course. In the mid-20th century, Kodak, the film and camera company, was frustrated by the limited number of pictures people were taking and devised a strategy to get them to take more. Kodak's advertising began associating photos with happiness. The goal was to get people in the habit of taking a picture whenever they wanted to show others what a good time they were having. All those smiling yearbook photos are a result of that successful campaign, as are most of the photos you see on Facebook and Instagram today. But photos as data can tell us much more than when high school seniors began to say cheese. Surprisingly, images may be able to tell us how the economy is doing. Consider one provocatively titled academic paper, Measuring Economic Growth from Outer Space. When a paper has a title like that, you can bet I'm going to read it. The authors of this paper, J. Vernon Henderson, Adam Storygaard, and David N. Weil, begin by noting that in many developing countries, existing measures of gross domestic product, GDP, are inefficient. This is because large portions of economic activity happen off the books, and the government agencies meant to measure economic output have limited resources. The author's rather unconventional idea? They could help measure GDP based on how much light there is in these countries at night. They got that information from photographs taken by a U.S. Air Force satellite that circles the Earth 14 times per day. Why might light at night be a good measure of GDP? Well, in very poor parts of the world, people struggle to pay for electricity. And as a result, when economic conditions are bad, households and villages will dramatically reduce the amount of light they allow themselves at night. Nightlight dropped sharply in Indonesia during the 1998 Asian financial crisis. In South Korea, nightlight increased 72% from 1992 to 2008, corresponding to a remarkably strong economic performance over this period. In North Korea, over the same time, nightlight actually fell, corresponding to a dismal economic performance during this time. In 1998, in southern Madagascar, a large accumulation of rubies and sapphires was discovered. The town of Ilakaka went from little more than a truck stop to a major trading center. There was virtually no nightlight in Ilakaka prior to 1998. In the next 5 years, there was an explosion of light at night. The authors admit their nightlight data is far from a perfect measure of economic output. You most definitely cannot know exactly how an economy is doing just from how much light satellites can pick up at night. The authors do not recommend using this measure at all for developed countries such as the United States, where the existing economic data is more accurate. And to be fair, even in developing countries, they find that nightlight is only about as useful as the official measures. But combining both the flawed government data with the imperfect nightlight data gives a better estimate than either source alone could provide. You can, in other words, improve your understanding of developing economies using pictures taken from outer space. Joseph Reisinger, a computer science PhD with a soft voice, shares the nightlight author's frustration with the existing datasets on the economies in developing countries. In April 2014, Reisinger notes, Nigeria updated its GDP estimate, taking into account new sectors they may have missed in previous estimates. Their estimated GDP was now 90% higher. They're the largest economy in Africa, Reisinger said, his voice slowly rising. We don't even know the most basic thing we would want to know about that country. He wanted to find a way to get a sharper look at economic performance. His solution is quite an example of how to reimagine what constitutes data and the value of doing so. Reisinger founded a company, Premise, which employs a group of workers in developing countries armed with smartphones. The employee's job? To take pictures of interesting goings-on that might have economic import. The employees might get snapshots outside gas stations or of fruit bins in supermarkets. They take pictures of the same locations over and over again. The pictures are sent back to Premise, whose second group of employees, computer scientists, turn the photos into data. The company's analysts can code everything from the length of lines in gas stations to how many apples are available in a supermarket to the ripeness of these apples to the price listed on the apples bin. Based on photographs of all sorts of activity, Premise can begin to put together estimates of economic output and inflation. In developing countries, long lines in gas stations are a leading indicator of economic trouble, so are unavailable or unripe apples. Premise's on-the-ground pictures of China helped them discover food inflation there in 2011 and food deflation in 2012, long before the official data came in. Premise sells this information to banks or hedge funds and also collaborates with the World Bank. Like many good ideas, Premise's is a gift that keeps on giving. The World Bank was recently interested in the size of the underground cigarette economy in the Philippines. In particular, they wanted to know the effects of the government's recent efforts, which included random raids, to crack down on manufacturers that produced cigarettes without paying a tax. Premise's clever idea? Take photos of cigarette boxes seen on the street. See how many of them have tax stamps, which all legitimate cigarettes do. They have found that this part of the underground economy, while large in 2015, got significantly smaller in 2016. The government's efforts worked, although seeing something usually so hidden, illegal cigarettes, required new data. As we've seen, what constitutes data has been wildly reimagined in the digital age, and a lot of insights have been found in this new information. Learning what drives media bias, what makes a good first date, and how developing economies are really doing is just the beginning. Not incidentally, a lot of money has also been made from such new data, starting with Messrs. Brin's and Page's tens of billions. Joseph Reisinger hasn't done badly himself. Observers estimate that Premise is now making tens of millions of dollars in annual revenue. Investors recently poured $50 million into the company. This means some investors consider Premise among the most valuable enterprises in the world, primarily in the business of taking and selling photos, in the same league as Playboy. There is, in other words, outsized value for scholars and entrepreneurs alike in utilizing all the new types of data now available and thinking broadly about what counts as data. These days, a data scientist must not limit herself to a narrow or traditional view of data. These days, photographs of supermarket lines are valuable data. The fullness of supermarket bins is data. The ripeness of apples is data. Photos from outer space are data. The curvature of lips is data. Everything is data. And with all this new data, we can finally see through people's lies. 4. Digital Truth Serum. Everybody lies. People lie about how many drinks they had on the way home. They lie about how often they go to the gym, how much those new shoes cost, whether they read that book. They call in sick when they're not. They say they'll be in touch when they won't. They say it's not about you when it is. They say they love you when they don't. They say they're happy while in the dumps. They say they like women when they really like men. People lie to friends. They lie to bosses. They lie to kids. They lie to parents. They lie to doctors. They lie to husbands. They lie to wives. They lie to themselves. And they damn sure lie to surveys. Here's my brief survey for you. Have you ever cheated on an exam? Have you ever fantasized about killing someone? Were you tempted to lie? Many people underreport embarrassing behaviors and thoughts on surveys. They want to look good, even though most surveys are anonymous. This is called social desirability bias. An important paper in 1950 provided powerful evidence of how surveys can fall victim to such bias. Researchers collected data from official sources on the residents of Denver, what percentage of them voted, gave to charity, and owned a library card. Then they surveyed the residents to see if the percentages would match. The results were, at the time, shocking. What the residents reported to the surveys was very different from the data the researchers had gathered. Take a look for yourself on the enhancement. Even though nobody gave their names, people in large numbers exaggerated their voter registration status, voting behavior, and charitable giving. 83% were reported on the survey as being registered to vote. The official count was 69%. 73% of people told the survey they voted in the last presidential election. The official count was 61%. 63% of people told the survey that they voted in the last mayoral election. The official count was 36%. 20% of people told the survey that they have a library card. The official count is 13%. And 67% of people reported to the survey that they gave to a recent community chest charitable drive, whereas the official count is 33%. Has anything changed in 65 years? In the age of the internet, not owning a library card is no longer embarrassing. But while what's embarrassing or desirable may have changed, people's tendency to deceive pollsters remains strong. A recent survey asked University of Maryland graduates various questions about their college experience. The answers were compared to official records. People consistently gave wrong information in ways that made them look good. Fewer than 2% reported that they graduated with lower than a 2.5 GPA. In reality, about 11% did. And 44% said they had donated to the university in the past year. In reality, about 28% did. And it is certainly possible that lying played a role in the failure of the polls to predict Donald Trump's 2016 victory. Polls on average underestimated his support by about 2 percentage points. Some people may have been embarrassed to say they were planning to support him. Some may have claimed they were undecided when they were really going Trump's way all along. Why do people misinform anonymous surveys? I asked Roger Torengo, a research professor emeritus at the University of Michigan and perhaps the world's foremost expert on social desirability bias. Our weakness for white lies is an important part of the problem, he explained. About one-third of the time, people lie in real life, he suggests. The habits carry over to surveys. Then there's that odd habit we sometimes have of lying to ourselves. There is an unwillingness to admit to yourself that, say, you were a screw-up as a student, says Torengo. Lying to oneself may explain why so many people say they are above average. How big is this problem? More than 40% of one company's engineers said they are in the top 5%. More than 90% of college professors say they do above average work. One quarter of high school seniors think they are in the top 1% in their ability to get along with other people. If you're deluding yourself, you can't be honest in a survey. Another factor that plays into our lying to surveys is our strong desire to make a good impression on the stranger conducting the interview, if there is someone conducting the interview, that is. As Torengo puts it, a person who looks like your favorite aunt walks in. Do you want to tell your favorite aunt you used marijuana last month? Do you want to admit that you didn't give money to your good old alma mater? For this reason, the more impersonal the conditions, the more honest people will be. For eliciting truthful answers, internet surveys are better than phone surveys, which are better than in-person surveys. People will admit more if they are alone than if others are in the room with them. However, on sensitive topics, every survey method will elicit substantial misreporting. Torengo here used a word that is often thrown around by economists, incentive. People have no incentive to tell surveys the truth. Another reason for lying is simply to mess with surveys. This is a huge problem for any research regarding teenagers, fundamentally complicating our ability to understand this age group. Researchers originally found a correlation between a teenager's being adopted and a variety of negative behaviors, such as using drugs, drinking alcohol, and skipping school. In subsequent research, they found this correlation was entirely explained by the 19% of self-reported adopted teenagers who weren't actually adopted. Follow-up research has found that a meaningful percent of teenagers tell surveys they are more than 7 feet tall, weigh more than 400 pounds, or have 3 children. One survey found 99% of students who reported having an artificial limb to academic researchers were kidding. How, therefore, can we learn what our fellow humans are really thinking and doing? In some instances, there are official data sources we can reference to get the truth. Even if people lie about their charitable donations, for example, we can get real numbers about giving in an area from the charities themselves. But when we're trying to learn about behaviors that aren't tabulated in official records, or we're trying to learn what people are thinking, their true beliefs, feelings, and desires, there is no other source of information except what people may deign to tell surveys. Until now, that is. This is the second power of big data. Certain online sources get people to admit things they would not admit anywhere else. They serve as a digital truth serum. Think of Google searches. Remember the conditions that make people more honest. Online? Check. Alone? Check. No person administering a survey? Check. And there's another huge advantage that Google searches have in getting people to tell the truth. Incentives. If you enjoy racist jokes, you have zero incentive to share that un-PC fact with a survey. You do, however, have an incentive to search for the best new racist jokes online. If you think you may be suffering from depression, you don't have an incentive to admit this to a survey. You do have an incentive to ask Google for symptoms and potential treatments. Even if you are lying to yourself, Google may nevertheless know the truth. A couple of days before the election, you and some of your neighbors may legitimately think you'll drive to a polling place and cast ballots, but if you and they haven't searched for any information on how to vote or where to vote, data scientists like me can figure out that turnout in your area will actually be low. Similarly, maybe you haven't admitted to yourself that you may suffer from depression even as you're Googling about crying jags and difficulty getting out of bed. You would show up, however, in an area's depression-related searches that I analyzed earlier in this audiobook. Think of your own experience using Google. I am guessing you have, upon occasion, typed things into that search box that reveal a behavior or thought that you would hesitate to admit in polite company. In fact, the evidence is overwhelming that a large majority of Americans are telling Google some very personal things. Americans, for instance, search for quote-unquote porn more than they search for quote-unquote weather. This is difficult, by the way, to reconcile with this survey data, since only about 25% of men and 8% of women admit they watch pornography. You may have also noticed a certain honesty in Google searches when looking at the way this search engine automatically tries to complete your queries. Its suggestions are based on the most common searches that other people have made, so autocomplete clues us in to what people are Googling. In fact, autocomplete can be a bit misleading. Google won't suggest certain words it deems inappropriate, such as cock, fuck, and porn. This means autocomplete tells us that people's Google thoughts are less racy than they actually are. Even so, some sensitive stuff often still comes up. If you type, why is, the first two Google autocompletes currently are, why is the sky blue, and why is there a leap day? Suggesting these are the two most common ways to complete this search. The third, why is my poop green? And Google autocomplete can get disturbing. Today, if you type in, is it normal to want to, the first suggestion is kill. If you type in, is it normal to want to kill, the first suggestion is my family. Need more evidence that Google searches can give a different picture of the world than the one we usually see? Consider searches related to regrets around the decision to have or not to have children. Before deciding, some people fear they might make the wrong choice, and almost always, the question is whether they will regret not having kids. People are 7 times more likely to ask Google whether they will regret not having children than whether they will regret having children. After making their decision, either to reproduce or adopt or not, people sometimes confess to Google that they rue their choice. This may come as something of a shock, but post-decision, the numbers are reversed. Adults with children are 3.6 times more likely to tell Google they regret their decision than are adults without children. One caveat that should be kept in mind throughout this chapter, Google can display a bias toward unseemly thoughts, thoughts people feel they can't discuss with anyone else. Nonetheless, if we are trying to uncover hidden thoughts, Google's ability to ferret them out can be useful. And the large disparity between regrets on having versus not having kids seems to be telling us that the unseemly thought in this case is a significant one. Let's pause for a moment to consider what it even means to make a search such as, "I regret having children." Google presents itself as a source from which we can seek information directly on topics like the weather, who won last night's game, or when the Statue of Liberty was erected. But sometimes we type our uncensored thoughts into Google without much hope that it will be able to help us. In this case, the search window serves as a kind of confessional. There are thousands of searches every year, for example, for "I hate cold weather," "people are annoying," and "I am sad." Of course, those thousands of Google searches for "I am sad" represent only a tiny fraction of the hundreds of millions of people who feel sad in a given year. Searches expressing thoughts rather than looking for information, my research has found, are only made by a small sample of everyone for whom that thought comes to mind. Similarly, my research suggests that the 7,000 searches by Americans every year for "I regret having children" represent a small sample of those who have had that thought. Kids are obviously a huge joy for many, probably most people, and despite my mom's fear that "you and your stupid data analysis are going to limit her number of grandchildren," this research has not changed my desire to have kids, but that unseemly regret is interesting, and another aspect of humanity that we tend not to see in the traditional datasets. Our culture is constantly flooding us with images of wonderful, happy families. Most people would never consider having children as something they might regret, but some do. They may admit this to no one, except Google. The truth about sex. How many American men are gay? This is a legendary question in sexuality research, yet it has been among the toughest questions for social scientists to answer. Psychologists no longer believe Alfred Kinsey's famous estimate, based on surveys that oversampled prisoners and prostitutes, that 10% of American men are gay. Representative surveys now tell us about 2-3% are, but sexual preference has long been among the subjects upon which people have tended to lie. I think I can use big data to give a better answer to this question than we have ever had. First, more on that survey data. Surveys tell us there are far more gay men in tolerant states than intolerant states. For example, according to a Gallup survey, the proportion of the population that is gay is almost twice as high in Rhode Island, the state with the highest support for gay marriage, than Mississippi, the state with the lowest support for gay marriage. There are two likely explanations for this. First, gay men born in intolerant states may move to tolerant states. Second, gay men in intolerant states may not divulge that they are gay. They are even more likely to lie. Some insight into explanation number one, gay mobility, can be gleaned from another big data source, Facebook, which allows users to list what gender they are interested in. About 2.5% of male Facebook users who list a gender of interest say they are interested in men. That corresponds roughly with what the surveys indicate. And Facebook too shows big differences in the gay population in states with high versus low tolerance. Facebook has the gay population more than twice as high in Rhode Island as in Mississippi. Facebook also can provide information on how people move around. I was able to code the hometown of a sample of openly gay Facebook users. This allowed me to directly estimate how many gay men move out of intolerant states into more tolerant parts of the country. The answer? There is clearly some mobility, from Oklahoma City to San Francisco, for example, but I estimate that men packing up their Judy Garland CDs and heading to someplace more open-minded can explain less than half of the difference in the openly gay population in tolerant versus intolerant states. Some may find it offensive that I associate a male preference for Judy Garland with a preference for having sex with men, even in jest, and I certainly don't mean to imply that all, or even most, gay men have a fascination with divas. But search data demonstrates that there is something to the stereotype. I estimate that a man who searches for information about Judy Garland is 3 times more likely to search for gay porn than straight porn. Some stereotypes, big data tells us, are true. In addition, Facebook allows us to focus in on high school students. This is a special group, because high school boys rarely get to choose where they live. If mobility explained the state-by-state differences in the openly gay population, these differences shouldn't appear among high school users. So what does the high school data say? There are far fewer openly gay high school boys in intolerant states. Only 2